Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, September 16, 2025. And here is the world news in brief. Mercosur signed trade deal with four European countries. Countries in the South American Mercosur bloc signed the deal with Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway, and Switzerland. The agreement announced Tuesday in Rio de Janeiro aims to deepen ties amid global commercial uncertainty sparked by President Donald Trump's tariffs. The deal creates a free trade zone for nearly 300 million people with a combined GDP of over $4.3 trillion. The agreement covers goods, services, and more, potentially lowering prices for items like Swiss chocolate and Norwegian cod in South America and beef in Europe. Associated Press. Chad voted to allow president to run unlimited times. The National Assembly endorsed constitutional revisions that would extend the presidential term from 5 to 7 years and allow the president to serve an unlimited number of times. President Mahamat Idris Deby seized power in Chad after his father, long-serving President Idris Deby, was killed in 2021. He claimed victory following a disputed election held after 3 years of military rule in May of 2024. There are fewer and fewer dissenting voices, said Ramaji Hoinathi, a senior researcher at the Africa-focused Institute for Security Studies, Reuters. New York judge tossed terrorism charges against Luigi Mangione. Judge Gregory Caro kept the second-degree murder charges in New York State's case over the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson last December. He ruled that although there is no doubt that the killing was not an ordinary street crime, New York law doesn't consider something terrorism simply because it was motivated by ideology. The Ivy League graduate has attracted a cult following as a stand-in for frustrations with the health insurance industry. Associated Press. Taliban banned Wi-Fi in an Afghan province to prevent immorality. This is the first ban of its kind since the Taliban took power in August of 2021. Government offices, the private sector, public institutions, and homes in the northern province now lack Wi-Fi internet, though mobile internet remains functional. On Tuesday, a provincial government spokesman said the leader ordered the complete ban. He mentioned an alternative would be developed, but provided no further details. Afghan authorities sometimes suspend mobile networks for security reasons during religious festivals. Associated Press. Colombia's Peace Tribunal issued first sentence on war crimes. 7 former leaders of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, were found guilty of policies leading to the kidnapping of 21,000 people. The court said the group kidnapped civilians for ransom and held soldiers and politicians to exchange for imprisoned rebels. Over the next 8 years, the former leaders must work on projects to find missing persons and remove landmines. They'll also engage in symbolic acts of reparation with victims. The tribunal was created as part of the 2016 peace deal between the Colombian government and the FARC rebels following decades of conflict. Associated Press. Poll: harsh political rhetoric fueling violence. Roughly 2 out of 3 Americans believe that the rhetoric used in talking about politics is encouraging violence, according to a Reuters Ipsos poll conducted in the days following the killing of conservative political activist Charlie Kirk. The 3-day poll, which closed on Sunday, revealed a nation unnerved by partisan divisions and worried over a spike in political violence that has also included the June slayings of a Democratic Minnesota lawmaker and her husband. Reuters. Trump filed a $15 billion defamation lawsuit against the New York Times. The lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court in Florida named several articles and one book written by two of the publication's journalists and published in the lead up to the 2024 election, saying that they are part of a decades-long pattern of intentional and malicious defamation against President Trump. Mr. Trump has gone after other media outlets, including filing a $10 billion defamation lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal and media mogul Rupert Murdoch in July, after the newspaper published a story reporting on his ties to wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein. Associated Press. Israel's military began its ground offensive in Gaza City. It is slowly closing in on the Palestinian territory's largest city, where block after block has already been destroyed in the Israel-Hamas war. Thousands of people streamed out in vehicles laden with their belongings, but hundreds of thousands more remain. The operation marks yet another escalation in a conflict that has roiled the Middle East for nearly 2 years and likely pushes any ceasefire farther out of reach. The military says it aims to destroy Hamas's military infrastructure. Meanwhile, a team of experts commissioned by the UN's Human Rights Council has concluded that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Israel has adamantly rejected the allegations. Associated Press. Malawians head to polls amid economic crisis. This year's presidential elections are marked by disillusionment. President Lazarus Chakwera took office in 2020 after a court-ordered rerun of disputed elections, a moment widely seen as a victory for democracy. But despite his promises, jobs remain scarce and daily expenses keep climbing. He faces a rematch with former President Peter Mutharika. Staff. Trump said U.S. struck an alleged Venezuelan drug vessel. It was the second such strike against a suspected drug boat in recent weeks. President Trump said on social media the attack killed three men, adding that it occurred in international waters. This comes amid a large U.S. military buildup in the southern Caribbean. Hours before Mr. Trump's post, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro said recent incidents were an aggression by the U.S. and that communications between the two governments had largely ended. Reuters. Syria struggling for unity amid divisions. President Hamed al-Sharia has won major diplomatic victories since seizing power 9 months ago, but he risks losing the battle that matters most, to hold his divided country together. In Syria's northeast, Kurdish forces are resisting integration after 14 years of civil war, demanding a new constitution to recognize their rights. In the southeast, members of the Druze community are calling for independence after violent clashes with governmental forces. White House requested $58 million for security after Charlie Kirk's shooting. The funding would go towards protecting the executive and judicial branches, reports Punchbowl News. The appeal comes amid growing concern in Washington over threats to public officials and calls to lower political tensions. Following deadly shootings of Minnesota legislators in June, the House expanded security protections for lawmakers in their home districts. Lawmakers are considering the latest request in the context of a stopgap spending bill to avoid a government shutdown. Staff. Qatar hosted summit in response to Israel's strike on Hamas in Doha. Arab and Islamic nations are hoping to present a united response to last week's attack. But as leaders offered different views about what to do, the group has few ways to restrain Israel in its war on Gaza. It's unclear what the summit will be able to achieve. Assembling the summit in less than a week, especially given its scale, is a notable achievement, the New York-based Soufan Center said. The key question is whether a summit will signal a shift towards more consequential measures against Israel, Associated Press. Global overfishing agreement now in effect. The World Trade Organization deal is meant to limit the depletion of fish stocks caused by excessive fishing. It requires governments to reduce subsidies doled out to fishing fleets, aiming to ensure the sustainability of wildlife in the world's seas and oceans. The long-wrought agreement took effect Monday after four more countries, Brazil, Kenya, Tonga, and Vietnam, adopted it, bringing the total to 112 nations. The WTO touts the deal as its first focusing on the environment and the first broad and binding multilateral agreement on ocean sustainability. U.S. said TikTok deal reached with China. Officials have reached a framework deal for the ownership of popular social video platform TikTok, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said, after weekend trade talks between the U.S. and China in Spain. He did not comment on the terms. In 2024, Congress and the White House used national security grounds to approve a U.S. ban on TikTok unless its Chinese parent company sold its controlling stake. President Donald Trump has repeatedly extended the deadline. The meeting in Madrid is the fourth round of trade talks between U.S. and Chinese officials since Mr. Trump launched new tariffs on Chinese goods in April, Associated Press. More Poles are signing up for voluntary military training. The Army is seeking to fill its ranks amid growing concerns over Russia's military aggression. Officials estimate that 40,000 volunteers will complete military training by the end of this year, more than double the 16,000 in 2022. Since the start of the war, Poland has increased its defense spending from 2.2% of economic output to 4.7% this year, Reuters. Our first article today is Syria holds elections without a popular vote. Why Syrians are still hopeful, by Tyler Luck, special correspondent. Damascus, Syria. Syria's first election since overthrowing the brutal dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad are not the open democratic polls that Syrian citizens risked their lives demanding over nearly 14 years of civil war. But many Syrians say they're okay with that, because they say these elections, which began on Monday, might not be open and free, but they are relatively fair. Across Syria, community leaders are choosing representatives to a parliament tasked with overhauling the country's laws and setting a new constitution. If the process prioritizes technocratic expertise over parties and politics, Syrians hope it's a step towards building a democratic legislature. In village halls, auditoriums, and offices across the country this week, community leaders are choosing representatives to send to a parliament tasked with overhauling the country's laws and setting a new constitution. It is a process many believe will form a parliament that might not be by the people, but will be for the people. A sea change in how parliamentarians represent and respond to their constituents in the war-torn country. And it is, Syrians hope, a historic first step towards building a responsive legislative authority. In interviews, they express patience with the process that prioritizes technocratic expertise over parties and politics to build a system they look forward to. Before, we had people that served a parliament. Now we hope to have a parliament that serves the people and the good of the nation, says Fatima, a lawyer from Quneitra who asked for her full name to be withheld. I don't care if it's a direct or indirect election. All I care is that it will lead to a parliament that votes for programs and laws that are for the people, not for a regime. Forming a new parliament and having a legislative authority passing laws has been a top priority for Syria's new government and for the business community. Yet, the state is unable to hold elections across all regions due to security challenges and the presence of armed rival factions opposed to the government in Damascus. Rather than a popular vote, it chose to hold indirect, closed polls. Across Syria, tens of electoral colleges comprising community leaders and notables are gathering, debating, and preparing to vote among themselves to send representatives to parliament. One-third of the parliament's 210 seats, 70, will be appointed by President Ahmed al-Sharaa, the Islamist-turned-pragmatist who assumed power after his coalition forced Mr. Assad from power last December. The other 140 seats will be selected by those electoral colleges. While average citizens cannot vote, any Syrian has the ability to challenge a candidate's eligibility, creating a type of reverse participation and a filter that seeks to ensure that incoming lawmakers serve their communities. In this process, set to conclude by the end of September and taking place largely behind closed doors, community leaders and activists are shortlisting Syrians who best represent the diverse fabric of the country and have a combination of a legal background, revolutionary credentials, and a vision for the new constitution. After overhauling laws and setting a new constitution, this parliament is to pave the way for yet another election after 3 to 5 years, this time a nationwide democratic popular vote. We wish to have direct elections, as they probably would have been more desired by citizens, says Nawar Najma, a physician and spokesperson for Syria's High Electoral Commission, the president-formed body that appointed the electoral colleges now selecting parliamentarians. But right now we are facing large demographic and logistical challenges in Syria in terms of distributing ballots and the dispersal of the displaced and refugees, making the ability to hold direct fair elections nearly impossible, Dr. Najma says. And we do not want to hold unfair elections like those held by the former regime. It is, proponents say, a way to guarantee that Syria's diverse fabric of sects, ethnicities, and social spheres are represented when the constitution is drafted. The social and demographic components must be represented in these electoral committees at all levels, Dr. Najma adds. The incoming parliament faces a formidable to-do list. In addition to drafting the new constitution, the body will be immediately tasked with overhauling a half-century's worth of laws from the previous dictatorship that are still on the books. For example, a law imposing a 3-year prison sentence for dealing in and carrying foreign currency is still technically in effect. So too are laws that were used to strip citizens of their lands and money for opposing the regime. Then there are the host of new laws that the interim government is looking to pass to transform the Ba'athist socialist country into a capitalist, global-oriented, open country and economy. In interviews, Syrian business owners say they are anxiously awaiting passage of a much-touted investors' law to encourage and protect foreign investment in Syria. Parliament, too, will need to ratify international conventions Syria seeks to join and new treaties, such as an under-discussion security agreement with Israel, a long-time adversary. Observers, political activists, candidates, and citizens in the streets agree. It is a task for technocrats and lawyers, not politicians. In the formation of the parliament, there has been a strong focus on technical expertise to study and issue laws, says Wael Olwan, an analyst at the Jusor Center for Studies, a Damascus-based research institute. This comes at the expense of politicians and representatives of the people. Hassan Mohedin, a lawyer and member of the Council of Notables in Duma, is one of the dozens of candidates currently taking part in the electoral colleges. I want to run as there is need for legal and revolutionary expertise, says Mr. Mohedin. We need legal experts who know the Syrian context and international standards to shepherd us through this interim period. The most important thing is that people feel parliamentarians are serving citizens, not citizens serving parliamentarians. Syrians say they welcome a technocratic parliament to help usher the country into a new phase of rebuilding, and are willing to wait to cast their ballot in a future election. Before we had a rubber-stamp parliament, says Aya, a mother of three in Damascus, all parliamentarians serve the regime and security services. Not anymore. We recognize that this is an interim period, says Majed Abu Ahmed, an engineering student. This election will lay the ground for the next election, which is when we will all be able to cast votes for political parties and programs. I'm looking forward to casting my vote, even if it is not now. Yet, even these carefully arranged closed-door elections fail to cover all of Syria. Southwestern Suwayda province, controlled by Druze separatists, as well as some regions controlled by the Kurdish-Syrian Democratic Forces in the northeast, are exempt from the elections due to the state's inability to enter and monitor polls. Instead, Mr. Sharah is expected to appoint members of these regions until elections can be held. It's a decision, observers say, that aims to avoid the pitfalls experienced in other post-conflict Arab states. The election of representatives of de facto powers in the ground in these three regions will lead to an obstructionist coalition in parliament, such as in Iraq and Lebanon, whose sole duty will be to delay progress in the issuance of laws, says Rehed Hassan, a legal expert at Jusor and a former member of the Syria National Council in Exile. Currently, no political parties in Syria are licensed or allowed to take part in elections. Instead, these political organizations are watching from the sidelines, supportive of the process and looking to lobby the new parliament to make sure it continues Syria's democratic transition. We as a party view that given the current conditions of Syria, the system of forming a parliament is appropriate, as long as there is no interference from the executive, says Absi Semesim, a member of the Republic Party formed in exile in Turkey. The new Syria needs a legislative body urgently to monitor the executive and issue laws, he says. This parliament will help facilitate our strategic goal of activating political life in Syria. We support the formation of parliament, even if it is not an open vote, Juma Lahib from the Syrian Future Movement, a coalition of liberal democratic parties. We plan to lobby and work with parliament directly to make sure a democratic opening follows. You have a right to an attorney. Massachusetts Bar Strike and the Sixth Amendment, by Troy Aiden Sambajan, staff writer. At the beginning of this year, the phrase constitutional crisis was everywhere. Was America heading for one? When would we know if we were in one? This summer, residents of one state arguably have been embroiled in one so quietly that most people haven't noticed. And it's a state that has been widely viewed as a model for the Sixth Amendment. That's the one that promises a right to counsel, as in you have a right to an attorney. If you cannot afford one, one will be appointed for you. The vast majority of criminal defendants in Massachusetts rely on bar advocates, private attorneys contracted with the courts for their constitutional right to counsel. Since May, those lawyers have refused to take new cases, staging a work stoppage to press lawmakers for higher wages. 60 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that lawyers in criminal courts are necessities, not luxuries. In Gideon v. Wainwright, the ruling was largely an unfunded mandate, which left the responsibility for representation to states. Massachusetts stands as both a model and a cautionary tale. "It's not a strike, it's a constitutional reckoning," says Bill Lane, a criminal defense attorney in Greenfield and former Boston public defender. He became a bar advocate in 2023. "The wages are so low, there's no reason for anyone to get into this job," he says. "The survivability of the bar advocate system is really at stake here." The effects have not just been theoretical. Hundreds of criminal defendants have had their cases dismissed because there weren't enough lawyers to represent them. 60 years ago, the United States Supreme Court ruled that lawyers in criminal courts are necessities, not luxuries. In Gideon v. Wainwright, however, the ruling was largely an unfunded mandate, which left the responsibility to states to figure out implementation, funding, and oversight. Massachusetts stands as both a model and a cautionary tale. This summer, the state legislature acted swiftly, but a deeper question remains. Can states build systems strong enough to fully uphold the Sixth Amendment? As of August, Massachusetts bar advocates earn $75 an hour for district court cases. That's a $10 an hour raise, with more coming next year. But bar advocates say it's still paltry compared with nearby states like Maine, which pays $150 an hour, and Rhode Island, which pays $112 hourly for indigent defendants. The work stoppage has led to more than 100 cases being dropped, including some for violent crimes such as domestic abuse and assaulting a police officer. Since May 27, there have been more than 6,100 unrepresented defendants in district and municipal courts. The bar strike raises questions about how much states should rely on private lawyers to provide the constitutional right to counsel for those who cannot afford a lawyer, called indigent defense. Every state relies on a mix of public defenders who are state employees and court-appointed private lawyers to provide the right to counsel. But only three states, Maine, North Dakota, and Massachusetts, rely on private attorneys for more than 60% of indigent cases. Massachusetts tops them all, with bar advocates handling about 80% of indigent defendants. "That heavy reliance may be the system's weak point," says Eve Brensick-Premis, director of the Public Defender Training Institute at the University of Michigan Law School. "If private lawyers handle 80% of indigent defense cases, and indigent defendants make up the vast majority of the criminal docket, it's kind of a recipe for a crisis," says Ms. Premis, who says low pay can also lead to real differences in the quality of representation. "If you don't want to be susceptible to these kinds of problems in the long term, you need to have a more robust role for fully employed institutional public defenders." Other states that rely heavily on court-appointed attorneys have faced similar shortages. In Maine, a lack of public defenders contributed to the release of a man with a history of violence in June 2024. 3 days later, he killed one person and engaged in an hours-long standoff with police before dying himself. The case drew national attention and prompted efforts to create more permanent public defender offices. Oregon has faced its own severe backlog, with roughly 4,000 defendants statewide awaiting legal representation. If Multnomah County alone, nearly 300 cases, including felonies, were dismissed because no public defender was available. Former District Attorney Mike Schmidt called the shortage an urgent threat to public safety. Oregon is now moving towards a hybrid model, hiring additional public defenders to handle at least 30% of indigent cases by 2035. Massachusetts is home to a large number of law schools and lawyers. That abundant supply has ironically contributed to low pay. Massachusetts is getting an incredible bargain out of their advocates, says Robert Kilmartin, a longtime federal attorney who became a bar advocate after retiring to Cape Cod, but it's at the expense of the Sixth Amendment. He worries that the low pay makes it nearly impossible to recruit and retain talented lawyers. If we can't attract good lawyers, the system collapses, he says. And that collapse isn't just about us. It's about the thousands of people left unrepresented in court. Massachusetts lawmakers responded in July with the largest raise in two decades, a $20 increase spread over 2 years, and pledged to hire 320 new public defenders. By the end of August, the state had hired 22 new staff attorneys. Massachusetts acted faster than many states, adds D.T. Goel of the Sixth Amendment Center, a nonprofit tracking public defense nationally. Other states don't have as sophisticated a structure, she says. When they face a crisis, they may not even be aware that there is one. However, despite the increase in pay, many bar advocates have not resumed taking new cases. The Massachusetts Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, in a press release, called the raise insufficient to resolve what it described as a constitutional crisis. The stakes extend far beyond clogged court dockets. A loss of confidence in the system may be as damaging as the backlog itself, says Eliza Hochman Bloom, an assistant professor of law and an expert on criminal procedure in Northeastern University. Most individuals within our carceral system already have a waning sense of the integrity of the system itself, says Ms. Bloom. Lack of access to counsel further erodes that trust. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you missed any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. From Sundance Kid to Activist, Robert Redford's legacy as a cinema icon. Robert Redford, who died at his home in Utah on September 16th, brought his golden touch to Hollywood, in front of and behind the camera, first as a 1970s Hollywood megastar to an award-winning director and champion of independent film. By Bob Thomas, Associated Press. Robert Redford, who died Tuesday, September 16th, was a Hollywood golden boy who became an Oscar-winning director, liberal activist, and godfather for independent cinema under the name of one of his best loved characters. After rising to stardom in the 1960s, Redford was one of the biggest stars of the 70s with such films as The Candidate, All the President's Men, and The Way We Were, capping that decade with the Best Director Oscar for 1980's Ordinary People, which also won Best Picture in 1980. His wavy blonde hair and boyish grin made him the most desired of leading men, but he worked hard to transcend his looks, whether through his political advocacy, his willingness to take on unglamorous roles, or his dedication to providing a platform for low-budget movies. His roles ranged from Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward to a mountain man in Jeremiah Johnson to a double agent in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and his co-stars included Jane Fonda, Meryl Streep, and Tom Cruise. But his most famous screen partner was his old friend and fellow activist and practical joker, Paul Newman. Their films, a variation of their warm, teasing relationship off-screen. Mr. Redford played the wily outlaw opposite Newman in the 1969's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, a box office smash from which Mr. Redford's Sundance Institute and Festival got its name. He also teamed with Newmans on 1973's Best Picture Oscar winner, The Sting, which earned Mr. Redford a Best Actor nomination as a young con artist in the 1930s Chicago. Film roles after the 70s became more sporadic as Redford concentrated on directing and producing, and his new role as patriarch of the independent film movement in the 1980s and 90s through his Sundance Institute. But he starred in 1985's Best Picture champion, Out of Africa, and in 2013 received some of the best reviews of his career as a shipwrecked sailor in All Is Lost, in which he was the film's only performer. In 2018, he was praised again in what he called his farewell movie, The Old Man and the Gun. I just figure that I've had a long career and that I'm very pleased with it. It's been so long, ever since I was 21, he told the Associated Press shortly before the film came out. I figure now, as I'm getting into my 80s, it's maybe time to move towards retirement and spend more time with my wife and family. Mr. Redford had watched Hollywood grow more cautious and controlling during the 70s and wanted to recapture the creative spirit of the early part of the decade. Sundance was created to nurture new talent away from the pressures of Hollywood, the Institute providing a training ground, and the festival, based in Park City, Utah, where Mr. Redford had purchased land with the initial hope of opening a ski resort. Instead, Park City became a place of discovery for such previously unknown filmmakers as Quentin Tarantino, Steven Soderbergh, and Paul Thomas Anderson and Darren Aronofsky. For me, the word to be underscored is independence, Mr. Redford told the AP in 2018. I've always believed in that word. That's what led to me eventually wanting to create a category that supported independent artists who weren't given a chance to be heard. The industry was pretty well controlled by the mainstream, which I was part of. But I saw other stories out there that weren't having a chance to be told, and I thought, well, maybe I can commit my energies to giving those people a chance. As I look back on it, I feel very good about that. Sundance was even criticized as buyers swarmed in looking for potential hits and celebrities overran the town each winter. We've never ever changed our policies for how we program our festival. It's always been built on diversity, Mr. Redford told the AP in 2004. The fact is that the diversity has become commercial, because independent films have achieved their own success. Hollywood, being just a business, is going to grab them. So when Hollywood grabs your films, they go, oh, it's gone Hollywood. By 2025, the festival had become so prominent that organizers decided they had outgrown Park City and approved relocating to Boulder, Colorado, starting in 2027. Mr. Redford, who had attended the University of Colorado in Boulder, issued a statement saying that change is inevitable. We must always evolve and grow, which has been the core of our survival. Mr. Redford was married twice, most recently to Sybil Sagers. He had four children, two of whom have died, Scott Anthony, who died in infancy, in 1959, and James Redford, an activist and filmmaker who died in 2020. Robert Redford was born Charles Robert Redford, Jr. on August 18, 1937, in Santa Monica, a California boy whose blonde good looks eased his way over an apprenticeship in television and live theater that eventually led to the big screen. Mr. Redford attended college on a baseball scholarship and would later star as a middle-aged slugger in 1984's The Natural, the adaptation of Bernard Malamud's baseball novel. He had an early interest in drawing and painting, then went on to study at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, debuting in Broadway in the late 1950s and moving into television on such shows as The Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and The Untouchables. After scoring a Broadway lead in Sunday in New York, Mr. Redford was cast by director Mike Nichols in a production of Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park, later starring with Ms. Fonda in the film version. Mr. Redford did miss out on one of Nichols' greatest successes, The Graduate, released in 1967. Nichols had considered casting Mr. Redford in the part eventually played by Dustin Hoffman, but Mr. Redford seemed unable to relate to the socially awkward young man who ends up having an affair with one of his parents' friends. "I said you can't play it. You can never play a loser," Nichols said during the 2003 screening of the film in New York. And Redford said, "What do you mean? Of course I can play a loser." And I said, "Okay, have you ever struck out with a girl?" And he said, "What do you mean?" And he wasn't joking. Mr. Redford died in his home at Sundance in the mountains of Utah, and the place he loved. Surrounded by those he loved, publicist Cindy Berger said in a statement, "No cause of death was provided." This story was reported by the Associated Press. Trump ignored TikTok ban, then announced a deal. Here's what it means. By Caitlin Babcock, staff writer. When President Donald Trump said September 15th that his administration had reached a deal with China to sell TikTok, a popular social platform built around catchy short videos, he said it would come as a happy news to the app's millions of users. But they may not have been on edge. Despite being banned in January, TikTok has remained fully operational as the Trump administration did not enforce the law, saying it was negotiating a deal. On the day before President Trump's inauguration, U.S. app stores faced penalties of $5,000 per TikTok user if they continued to distribute or host the app. Congress, citing concerns that the Chinese government would gain access to TikTok's users' personal data, had come to a rare bipartisan consensus. It passed a law requiring TikTok to be banned unless China signed off on a sale by ByteDance, the app's parent company. Extensions ordered by Mr. Trump have kept the app available and the ban from being enforced, but the future of TikTok remained unsolved. Congress said TikTok should be banned unless it was sold by its Chinese owner. For months, President Trump has controversially delayed enforcing that law. He now says the U.S. is reaching a deal with China that meets America's security concerns. Even if a deal with China occurs, the journey has raised a lasting question about the balance of powers and whether a president can simply decline to enact a law passed by Congress. The Trump administration said Monday it has reached an agreement with China to keep TikTok running in the United States. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent called the agreement a framework and said Mr. Trump will speak with Chinese leader Xi Jinping on Friday to complete the deal. The U.S. and China had been engaged in talks in Madrid this weekend to discuss trade on other issues. The administration has not released details about the deal, including who TikTok's proposed buyer is. Mr. Bessent said the deal addresses U.S. security concerns while being fair for the Chinese. Spurred by fears that the Chinese government could gain access to TikTok users' personal data, Congress overwhelmingly passed the ban in April of 2024. The law prohibits the distribution of TikTok as long as it has ownership based in a country designated as a foreign adversary. The text of the law did give the president the ability to grant a one-time extension of not more than 90 days before enforcing the ban. If there has been significant progress on divesting the app from its Chinese owner, the president must also certify this progress to Congress. On April 4th, when the original extension was set to expire, Mr. Trump announced he would allow TikTok to keep running for another 75 days, exceeding the 90-day limit set by Congress. He passed a third extension in June, set to expire September 17th. TikTok has seen several wealthy bidders in the interim, including companies like Amazon and Oracle. U.S. government officials have twice indicated that TikTok was close to having a buyer, only to have negotiations with the Chinese government fizzle out. In late July, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said in an interview on CNBC that TikTok would go dark in September if China didn't give the U.S. more control over the app by the next deadline. On August 19th, however, the White House launched its own TikTok account. The following day, the Chinese Communist Party published an editorial in which they expressed hope that Mr. Trump would extend his non-enforcement of the ban indefinitely. After President Joe Biden signed the TikTok ban into law in 2024, TikTok sued the federal government. The case went to the Supreme Court, and all 9 members upheld the ban as constitutional. When Mr. Trump ordered the second extension of the ban in April, Attorney General Pam Bondi wrote to executives of technology companies like Apple, saying the companies would not be held liable for distributing the app. Ms. Bondi also said Mr. Trump had decided an abrupt shutdown of TikTok would interfere with the president's responsibilities over national security and foreign policy. In other words, she asserted that the president had the prerogative to nullify the law's effects. In March, several Democratic members of Congress who opposed the TikTok ban wrote to express their concern that the administration was ignoring the requirements of the law. A few Republican members have also expressed discontent, with Senator Chuck Grassley telling reporters in June that he wanted to know that the Congress isn't being played. Daniel Farber, the author of Contested Ground, How to Understand the Limits of Presidential Power, says Congress's ability to push back on this is limited. One avenue members could take would be to try to coerce Mr. Trump by refusing to confirm his appointees or to fund something he wants until he enforces the law. However, there appears to be little political will in Congress to take direct action to try and enforce the ban. Presidents are sometimes able to exercise legal discretion about which laws to enforce, says Alan Rosenstein, a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. That's in the same way that a police officer might decide not to pull someone over for going slightly over the speed limit. But according to Ms. Bondi's letters, Mr. Trump is not making a claim about discretion. Instead, she told companies they had made no violation of the act. In other words, the administration wasn't just going to look the other way if technology companies distributed TikTok. It openly asserted that the companies weren't breaking the law. Mr. Farber says that's a critical distinction. It's true that the president has the right to prioritize laws, but that doesn't mean that he can simply decide that he doesn't like some laws and is going to enforce won't enforce them at all, he says. There is a theoretical basis for the administration's argument that it doesn't have to enforce a law it says it will interfere with the president's constitutional responsibilities, says Mr. Rosenstein. For example, Congress can't pass a law saying the president is not a commander-in-chief, as the Constitution explicitly states he is. A Supreme Court case during the Obama administration said the president didn't have to follow a law of Congress that would have required him to recognize Jerusalem as part of Israel. But according to Mr. Rosenstein, Mr. Trump's claim that he can overrule a TikTok ban passed by Congress because it involves national security takes that argument to an unworkable level. By that logic, almost anything that had any relation to foreign affairs or other countries could interfere with the president's constitutional powers, he says. And he doesn't think the fact that Mr. Trump reached a deal changes anything. You can't pick and choose, he says. You can't say, I'm going to let the president disobey the laws only when it will lead to a good outcome. Editor's note, this story was updated on September 16th, the day of its original publication, to clarify that President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping plan to speak, not to meet face-to-face, on September 19th. And here's some pieces from the Monitor's View. Juggling Change and Challenges at the UN. The United Nations is confronting deep funding cuts and political differences. 80 years after its founding, can its multinational membership hold on to its universal ideals? By the Monitor's editorial board. This month's annual gathering of the United Nations marks 80 years since its founding charter was adopted in the waning months of World War II. Since then, the UN's membership has almost quadrupled, from 51 nations to more than 190 nations. It has achieved successes in global health, peacekeeping, women's and children's rights, poverty reduction, and treaties that govern international communications, atomic energy, and air transport. But alongside these, the UN's challenges and divisions have also multiplied. The United States has long been the UN's largest funder. However, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio claims the post-war global order is not just obsolete, it is now a weapon being used against us. The administration has accused the International Criminal Court, for example, of unfair investigation of U.S. personnel. The U.S. has recently slashed foreign assistance in general and scaled down participation in several multinational agencies and security alliances. The UN now faces difficult decisions over its funding and purpose, requiring it to reflect on the changeless values that drove its creation. The UN's founding ideals, dignity, justice, solidarity, are not obsolete, says Jem Bendel, a former professor at the University of Cumbria in Britain and consultant to the UN post-war structures. "We're designed for a world that no longer exists," he agrees. "But their spirit," he writes, "represents a future in if we dare to change course." Many citizens across the globe, notably Americans, still believe in the multinational cooperation. In July, the Pew Research Center reported that 57% of Americans hold a favorable view of the UN, an increase of 5 percentage points over the last year. Support for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is committed to mutual defense as well as democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, is at 77%, according to Gallup. The American Enterprise Institute concludes that more than half of 40 selected multinational organizations contribute significantly to some in U.S. interests, or some in U.S. interests. And the high-level UN sessions next week, world leaders will present their views on the future of the UN and diverse global issues, including the wars in Ukraine and Gaza, as well as civil conflicts and climate change. There will likely be abstentions, vetoes, or walkouts. Pursuing peace is not easy and will require the UN to be better at mediating conflict and foregoing consensus. Upholding the UN's founding purpose, U.S. President Harry Truman said in 1945, would tax the moral strength and fiber of us all. But having the UN Charter at all was a cause for profound thanksgiving, he said. It was proof that nations can state their differences, can face them, and then can find common ground on which to stand. That is the essence of keeping the peace in the future. The power of honesty in Nepal. Youth protests against corruption felled a government and then led to a search for a few honest leaders. The Himalayan nation may have found them. By the Monitor's editorial board. Over 2 days last week, young people in the Himalayan nation of Nepal took to the streets in protest against corrupt politicians. Their initial complaint was aimed at the adult children of the elite, flaunting their lavish wealth in online posts. When the government then banned most social media, the outrage escalated. For Generation Z, or people born between 1997 and 2012, you don't mess with their online access and connectivity. When the demonstrations caused the government to fall, Nepal's Gen Z was forced to switch from condemning others to championing their ideals, namely honesty in government. Like the ancient Greek philosopher Diogenes, they searched the public square for a few honest leaders, or those without any self-interested motives. True to their digital savvy and egalitarian spirit, the leading youth group, Hami Nepal, used ChatGPT and an online poll to latch onto two names, Balendra Shah, the young mayor of the capital, Kathmandu, who is an independent as well as a former rap star, and Sushila Karki, a former Supreme Court Chief Justice and the first woman to hold that post. In a country ranked as one of the most corrupt in Asia, these two are seen as not only exemplars of integrity, but also leaders who try to bring out honesty in others. During the protests, for example, Mr. Shah, who is only 35, praised Gen Z for their fire, vision, and honesty. Ms. Karki has been called Nepal's Lady Justice after her court stood up to the government in choosing the National Police Chief in 2017. As mayor, Mr. Shah has urged police to not take bribes. If you remember that honesty is the best policy, you will advance a lot in life, he said. Last year, after a constitutional lawyer won a case in the Supreme Court stopping a corrupt land deal, the mayor said the result was a prime example of the power of honesty. In the end, ChatGPT's artificial intelligence leaned towards picking Ms. Karki as the caretaker prime minister. Already retired, she says she will bow out after elections in March. The youth and their ideals are the engine of reform in Nepal, she said, while her long-time experience is only a guardrail. Mr. Shah praised the choice, and in a country where more than half the people are younger than age 30, he still has plenty of time and support to show others the power of honesty. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.